I'm Mark Peterson, and this is the Stronger Philanthropy Podcast. This is episode 13. This is where we love giving well. In today's podcast, you are in for a treat. In it, we interview Jack Kirvin on his philanthropy. Jack advanced in the banking sector, then took a few of his companies public. In the process, he created a family foundation to steward this wealth for the social good of others. The Kirvin's philanthropy might look different than that which you might expect. Normally, you might picture a foundation with a public-facing profile, interested in engaging with many sorts of charities. In Jack and Shirley Kirvin's case, they have chosen to focus deep on the marginalized. Specifically, Jack has contributed significantly into one organization, Prison Fellowship International. He serves as a volunteer on the international board and has dedicated decades to ensuring the organization is robust and healthy. That, too, is philanthropy. We learn about Jack's background, his involvement in Prison Fellowship International, and more recently, his leadership in advancing the cause of the Roundtable, an emerging organization designed to serve fellow philanthropists. Grantmakers that care about doing good philanthropy should take note and join this community. Jack will explain why. He finishes with some vulnerable sharing about the transition of wealth in his own family. Let's enter into conversation with Jack now. Jack Kirvin, welcome to our podcast today.
Thank you. Good to be here, Mark.
Thanks for taking some time and arranging to meet with me in Oakville. This is where you're from, isn't it, originally?
Well, did 32 years here.
Okay.
Originally Windsor, Toronto, grew up in Milton.
Milton has really changed over these years.
Fastest growing city in Canada, apparently.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about yourself.
Married for 48 years, as of May 25th.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Three children. 10 grandchildren between 3 and 18. First one goes off to university this year, which is another milestone that makes you realize you're getting older. And I grew up in Milton and went to the University of Windsor because it was a brand new university and a 61% average could get you in. Where I met Shirley, who had a 91% average or something.
And she's the smart one, is she?
She's the smart one, yeah. And I did 5 years there with a master's in international relations and went to work in banking for 16 years.
Okay.
Corporate banking, mostly investment banking.
So was your education in finance at all?
Or no? Nothing to do. But
interesting.
Yeah, it was 1969, and I remember when the Bank of Nova Scotia first interviewed me, and there were jobs everywhere for graduates.
Wow.
I mean, it's probably hard for younger people to understand that. But the guy from Human Resources said, I have to hire 25 BAs and 5 MAs. So he says, you're one of the MAs. And they really didn't care what your discipline was.
Wow.
It was more the fact that you had
got an education,
focused enough for 5 years to get an MA.
Wow.
And went to work in the investment department for 6 years. Then I left and joined the Mercantile Bank of Canada, which is a Citibank affiliate. Mm-hmm. And that was corporate lending. And my last job there was to help sell the bank, and which we did to the National Bank. Mm-hmm. And then I started my own businesses, and that's what I did from then on, was with partners.
Mm-hmm.
But
What sorts of businesses did you get involved in?
Well, we were in merchant banking.
Yeah.
And my definition of merchant banking was doing whatever it's profitable to do at any point in the cycle. So it was pretty freeing. And then after a few years of doing that, it kind of morphed into what's called private equity now. And initially with money from institutions and high net worth individuals. And then after a period of time, on my own with a couple of partners and investing our own money.
Hmm.
So, which still goes on. My son runs the business today.
Okay.
So that's the business side.
Yeah.
And the education side, if you feel like.
And you and your wife had 3 kids during this time.
We did. Jennifer, who's 47.
I think 40. I've met Jennifer.
Yep. So Jennifer runs the Curvin Family Foundation, which is a little foundation we have.
Okay.
And Laura, who's a year younger. And then Joe's 5 years younger, so Joe's 40.
Right.
The 2 girls each have 4 kids, and Joe has 2.
Wow.
Yeah.
So family gatherings are
family gatherings.
Busy.
Are 18, as it turns out, yeah.
So tell me about your decision to create your foundation. What led to that decision?
Very simple. I found myself with a large win coming up. We had taken a company called Philip Environmental public, and I was going to leave, and I was going to sell all my shares, and I realized I would have a large gain. So what am I going to do with it? And creating a foundation allowed me a place to take money and put it there. For tax reasons, I would get the deduction.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, I know that the longer I hold on to money, the less I want to give it away. But, you know, when you're given or when you've earned, you know, a lot of money at one time, you can feel especially generous because you've now got more money than you ever thought you would have. So you can put a big chunk of it. You can give away a big chunk. But where does it go?
Right.
And I didn't want to have to figure that out. So a foundation's perfect. You put it in there.
It's kind of a holding tank.
It's a holding tank. Yeah. And that's all it was because the foundation never got above $1 million.
Yeah.
Because we would basically distribute it all fairly quickly.
What have you focused on in the philanthropy side?
Yeah, mostly the last, the last 10 years for sure, it's been the marginalized, the poor. I would say that probably 80% of what we do is in that area, and more of it is offshore, third world countries. Africa especially is a place that I've fallen in love with.
Hmm. Yeah. Where in particular?
Well, I think the places that I've been to most, you know, as you get to know more and more people and you get deeper and deeper into the needs, and that helps you see solutions.
Mm.
So Rwanda, for sure, where our family and some friends have just begun a program in Rwanda. And in fact, we're all heading there in September on a vision trip. And a lot of West Africa, probably, so Burkina Faso, more than East, more than English Africa, more Francophone Africa.
Mm-hmm.
That would be more of it if I had to pick an area that we spend more time in. But right now, Rwanda is, and Zambia is our second area that we're interested in right now.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah. But it's because I've known the people there that are on the ground for 25 years, probably, 20 years for sure. They've stayed in our home, you know, and these are the executive directors and the regional directors of Prison Fellowship International. So the director of Prison Fellowship Rwanda and the director of Prison Fellowship Zambia are people that we know well, we trust. We've been there a number of times.
You've opened your heart and home to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Prison Fellowship International, what is your involvement with that organization? It's a charity.
Right. So PFI is it's a charity. It's registered in the U.S. and Canada, and it's in 120-plus countries. Each country has its own national ministry run by nationals, indigenous people, funded by them. And PFI, whose role is 34 years old now.
Mm.
And the first 31 years, its role was as a secretariat. So we didn't send money to the national ministries. We basically provided a place where...
Like an association type of thing?
Right.
Yeah.
So we would do courses for them, how to create a board of directors, how to fundraise, how to lead a significant Bible study, that kind of thing. Uh-huh. And we'd bring them together regionally, and every 4 years, we'd bring all of them together, 1,000-plus people.
And so when you're saying you would do this, were you on the board at that point?
So I was before I got on the board, I sat on a committee that looked at new initiatives, and then I joined the board in 99.
Oh, 99. Yeah. So you've been on that board for a long time.
I'm the second oldest, yeah. Oh, okay. And I became treasurer, vice chairman, then chairman, and I stepped down last October as chairman. So now I'm old person on the board who's been around a long time. Yeah.
Institutional history is within you.
Yeah, and that's one of the
That's valuable.
Yeah, there's two of us on the board that they are old people, and they say you can't go yet because you know the background.
So at the same time that you're running your businesses, you were also serving on this board.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And 3 years ago, 4 years ago, five of us met in San Francisco and decided it's not enough to be a secretariat. We need to do more because all of us had traveled extensively throughout the world into prisons and the rest of it. And we knew that there were two main areas that we weren't doing an effective job. The national ministries worked at it, but didn't have the money, didn't have the focus, the teaching to do. One was just leading prisoners to an understanding of who they are and who God is and the role of Jesus as a mediator. So that was one. There were lots of Bible studies in prisons and jails, but most of them were preaching at the prisoners. And we wanted to start a study that they would come to their own conclusions. Mm-hmm. And the other area of great need is for the children and the families of prisoners, especially in the third world. If you go into prison, your family is ostracized from the village, from the community that you live in. And they often physically move. The kids going to school are mocked or bullied.
Wow.
And community is so important, as you know, in the third world. And if you've got a 14-year-old daughter and she's going to marry somebody, it's probably somebody within the community.
Right.
And if you know their family, if the father's gone off to prison,
right,
you're not going to let her. So that guy, those children, boys and girls, find themselves ostracized. Mm. They're just cut out of the community life, which is why they get missed by Compassion, by World Vision, not on purpose, but they're not in the village anymore. Mm-hmm. They're not in the school role anymore. They're not picked up in the local church because they've moved to get away from, or they've been pushed away from the community, and they just kind of fall off the books. Mm. So that's the other area that we've moved into. So in the what we call the prisoner's journey, which is the Gospel of Mark, we do an eight week course, and there's a video at the beginning with a really exciting guy who's about 6'4". He's a Maori from New Zealand.
Okay.
He's got tattoos everywhere. He's got no hair, but he's got this bull head with this barrel chest.
Very imposing.
Yeah. And you get the impression that, you know, his message basically, every time you see him on the video, and he stays through the 8 weeks, video at the beginning of the session, then they break into groups with volunteers who lead them through the Gospel of Mark. And then a video at the end of the session. And he's in all of that for 8 weeks. So 16 times the participants hear him. And the subliminal message is, you know, if God can do something with me, you haven't done anything like I've done.
Yeah.
So, like, if you think you're beyond hope, look at me.
What led to your attraction to working with prisoners?
Yeah.
You know, like, that's an interesting area to get involved in.
Yeah, for sure. And, you want to stop discussion at a cocktail party. People say, oh, I heard you were just in, you know, Pakistan. Yeah, what was that like? And you say, well, I was just going into prisons, and people have.
You've been in jails all over the world.
Yeah. In fact, I, for reasons that don't matter, I added them up probably a year ago, and it was 61 countries.
Seriously?
And, yeah, a couple of hundred prisons, 100 and something prisons.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what led to this?
Yeah. So a fellow named Norm Allen introduced me to Ron Nickel, who was the president of Prison Fellowship International, at a couples retreat, asked if we would lead communion together, which we did. And 3 months later, Ron called me and said, you worked in a bank, didn't you? And I said, I did. And he said, so you know something about how to manage money, but basically it's a fund, about $12 million that was left to Prison Fellowship.
Like an endowment?
No, it was to be a venture capital fund for new initiatives to keep kids out of prison. So you would write into the fund and say, I've got this great idea how we can keep the kids in my neighborhood out of prison.
Right.
And they'd give you get the stats behind it and all of that and understand the need. And they'd write all that up and then they'd send it in and say, here's what we want to do and here's a budget. So we would look at that. I ended up on the board of this thing, not just putting together the application process and the monitoring process and, you know, who can get it, who can sign off, all that stuff that you do.
Yeah.
And anyway, so that was it. I spent 2 days down there. I came back. I still had never met a prisoner except a friend of mine's son who was in Metro East Detention Center. And two or three months after that, Ron called and said, would you sit on this board? And I said, well, let me think about it. I don't know anything about prison ministry. And he said, no, but you understand risk, reward, and how to. Mm-hmm. So I did that. And after a year of doing that, he said, you want to go to Southeast Asia for a 16-day trip? We're going to go to 7 countries, look at prisons. And I had just sold my interest in Philip Environmental, which I mentioned earlier. So I was free.
So the timing worked out.
Timing was perfect. Yeah, it was a God thing. And off we went. Norm Allen, Ron, myself, you can only imagine. And a guy named Peter Falk, who's with Prison Fellowship Canada on their board. You either say, this is not for me, for a whole bunch of reasons, and or you have your heart just is filled with compassion for these people who, Chuck Colson, who started Prison Fellowship, called them the least of the lost. And certainly in the third world especially, I find that they are the least of the lost. Mm-hmm. They're the forgotten ones. Mm-hmm. There's little money in African countries for social welfare.
Right.
So you can imagine how much they've got for prisons.
Right.
None. So food.
So I'm sure it's miserable conditions.
Some of West Africa, which is where my heart is tugged the hardest, is awful.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine the worst you can imagine. And it's prisons with no routine, nothing to teach, no food. And, maybe some high-calorie starch, yucca plant ground up or beaten up, once or twice, but it's all empty calories if you get it. And if you don't have somebody bringing you food, family or an aid group, then you die.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my first prison I walked into was Stanley Prison in Hong Kong, which is not bad. I mean, as prisons go, I didn't know that. It was my first. But I walked in and they take your passport and everything else you have. And then you hear the door clang behind you. And then there's kind of that realization that you don't even have identification on you. And here you are. And it's a little scary. And then you meet these guys. I mean, the first guy I met was a guy who was playing a guitar in the corner. And he was in for multiple murders. And he's, you quickly realize that this is a person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he understands what he's done. And he understands he'll spend the rest of his life. In those days, there was no death penalty. The British got rid of the death penalty. But, of course, Hong Kong was being taken over in 99
by China. Yeah.
By China. So that's what they were. That was the biggest fear amongst the Christians who did prison ministry. And amongst those prisoners was that, of course, there would be the death penalty would come back.
Mm.
So,
wow. Did it come back?
No.
No, it didn't. Your work has also involved a new venture called the Round Table, which
yes. You've
talked to me before about.
Yeah.
And I'd love you to just describe that to us. And I know it's of interest to people who are interested in philanthropy.
Yeah, yeah.
Our listeners.
So there's the Greg Pannoyer, as you know, started the Round Table. And it's been going for, I'm going to say, kind of formally, I think about 3 years now. And I joined the board as chair last July, so almost a year. And you can listen to Greg describe what it is.
I'd rather hear you describe it. Well, I've heard Greg describe it quite a bit.
Yeah, and the summary of Greg's would be restoring joy to people who give, because you've been in that position running your foundation, that the requests never stop, and it can get stressful, and you can get confused. You can find yourself doing things that you wouldn't have done as much to that charity because it's never been a priority, but a friend of yours brought it, and so you do things for reasons that often aren't the best reasons. So my goal for the foundation, which is Greg's, but it's now down to the practical level, mm-hmm. I think, is not only to teach us who are philanthropists, give us an understanding of who we are in the world, what our obligation is to our neighbor, to the alien at the door, and understand our spiritual motivations, if any, but to build a framework around the giving that leads you to understand and know and be comfortable with saying no.
Yeah.
To have boxes, if you like, and understand this is my priority. So I've learned that my priority is the marginalized in the third world.
Yeah.
And behind that are the marginalized in this world. So I'm involved with Kerr Street Ministries and Frontline Ministry and two Oakville organizations. For the same reason I'm involved with Prison Fellowship in Africa.
Right.
And once I came to that understanding, it allowed me to say no to a lot of people. But more importantly, I have much more focus and therefore more satisfaction, more sense of being in God's will, more sense of, Greg would say joy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I recognize joy unless it's my kids or my grandkids or my wife. But, I feel much better.
And the strategic vision and purpose is being lived out, right?
Yeah.
Now.
So we have regional meetings where we have speakers come and talk about how you can move closer to that, building that framework. And I hope one day that we will have a course for a day and a half or 2 days. It's let's build your framework where the participants feel comfortable enough to share details of their foundation, if you like, or the money that they have put aside for charitable giving, and that we can give each other advice and learn from each other.
Yeah, when you mentioned earlier your own story about creating your foundation, it was you were having a liquidity event. You were having a moment when you had, for tax reasons, the foundation was the thing that you created, but without having thought through the philosophy or the strategy around what to do with that money once you got it.
So I found myself once, third year into the foundation. In those days I was working, so there were liquidity events, every once in a while. and the money come in, and then sit down and figure out where it's going to go. And at the end, I said that our family was getting together, and I said to Jennifer, who has worked for me for one day a week for the last 20 years, and I said, hey, let's take a look at where the money has gone in the first 3 years that we've been doing this, and we can share that with the other members of the family. And, you know, and we took a look at it, and the number two thing was education.
Huh.
And I thought, how the heck did we ever, could education become number two?
Because that wasn't your passion, right?
No, I mean, not that I knew, you know, sort of thing. So I'm involved, I've been involved with Tyndale for 17 years, and I'm the longest sitting member of the Tyndale Foundation, too. Oh. So I guess when you get me on a board, I can stick. And but at that time, Tyndale had a capital call, and so did King's
Christian Collegiate.
Christian Collegiate was just being built.
Right.
And so there was a call.
Christian school in Oakville.
Yeah. So it was being built. And then, of course, a couple of years after it was built, they did an addition, or 4 years or 3 years. Somehow it all... But anyway, so all this money, I mean, all good causes.
Yeah.
But if I had had a framework, don't tell the people at Tyndale or King's. But, you know, I wouldn't have given that much in those. But, you know, it was a real shock to me and made me realize that, wow, I got to get a handle on this.
Yeah.
I wasn't paying enough attention.
Yeah. Yeah, it's easy to... I can see how so easily that would happen.
Yeah, well, you would know.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
And you have to be conscious of everything you have been doing and where you're going. Yeah. Otherwise, you'd definitely lose track.
Yeah. And you need... And so you need to learn that, and you need to learn that you have to be rigid. I've got... two ministries that we stopped giving to because they stopped. I mean, run by people I love, who I'm friends with, and they understand. But, you know, if you can't give me regular reports, if you can't give me a financial statement, then I can't be a significant supporter.
Yeah.
That's like you come up with rules because they work for you.
Yeah. Just going back to the round table, yep. Just for a moment. Who is it for, and can you join?
Yeah. So the idea, yes, joining is easy. It's basically $1,000. I think it's $1,500 for a family.
Okay.
And
so there's a membership fee then.
Yeah, membership fee, and it's so that allows you to come to certain events. It means quarterly you're going to get. If there's a new book out in philanthropy. You're going to get that book. If there's a podcast that comes up, if there's an article written on anything to do with philanthropy, really, you'll just automatically get that sent to you.
You know, the newsletters are really meaningful. There's mm-hmm. always good information in those.
Right. So regular contact, yeah. And then opportunities to meet with like-minded people mm-hmm. in a forum, and groups are 8 people, 10 people, maybe 12. And it's a learning forum. There's a facilitator, somebody teaching on a certain aspect of, you know, the generational, the transfer of wealth mm-hmm. is now a big, big item because, I mean, you read the numbers and, I don't know, Canada's going to transfer $3 trillion in wealth from my generation to the next one. The interesting thing there is that we had a family meeting. Our first family meeting was January to mm-hmm. talk about, because our state's complicated because we do private investments. So we have shares in this company that makes widgets and that company that makes something else. And it's just complicated.
Yeah, messy.
So we had a family meeting. I sat there, which was excellent. You know, I wasn't sure it was going to be excellent, but it was. And I looked at my kids, and I realized at their age, 40 to 47, that Shirley's 71. I'm assuming Shirley will outlive me because the stats say that, and because her dad lived to 94 and her mom to 87.
Right.
So my dad, mom didn't get past 71.
And Shirley has tons of energy. Nothing stopping her.
Right. And that, and that little body can... doesn't need as much blood pumped to keep going as mine does. So But it hit me, if Shirley's 71, if she lives to, say, 90,
yeah,
that's 19 years.
Yeah.
So Jennifer will be 66. So, you know, who wants to get their inheritance at 66 years of age? I mean, they can use it more now,
right,
when they've got four kids on their heading for university and all the rest of it. So it made a major change in what we're going to do, and we are moving assets to them sooner rather than later, rather than waiting for one of us to die. And when I've mentioned that to other people in our stage, it's like a light bulb goes off and says, yeah.
It's like permission. Like there's, we have this track in our minds that says that it has to happen when you die.
Yeah, right.
But why?
But no.
It doesn't need to. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's like we have eulogies when people die.
Yeah.
You kind of think, gee, I wish we'd said that a year ago. You know, like we should have these celebrations of life. As soon as somebody hears that they've got something, it's going to, you know, forget the funeral. We should have them.
Have you figured out what's going to happen to your foundation?
Yeah.
After your...
Yeah. So the foundation doesn't have much in it.
Yeah.
More now than it used to have because we've begun the process of moving. Jennifer is going to run the foundation.
Okay.
So we've split our... I was going to say their inheritance was not our estate. And that was something that you have to introduce to the kids, you know. So we're going to put 40% in the foundation and 20% to each of the three kids. So that's something that, you know, you have to talk through with family, and that's...
How did that conversation go?
It went really well.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know when afterwards they might have said, wow, I think we just lost some money there, but but it seemed to go really well. And, you know, there's, you know, mom and dad, it's your money. You can do whatever you want with it. So I think that was fine.
Yeah.
But better that they know now than they hear when the will is read.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the idea of the first family meeting. And we also determined who was going to get the cottage. So now we need to have another one to talk about some other things.
It's complicated, isn't it?
Well, it's more complicated than I ever imagined.
Yeah.
Like, I think I'm a pretty simple guy. You know, and you can't just do that and say 40% goes to the foundation and 20 to each of the kids. You can't, because apparently foundations can't hold private company shares.
Right.
And everything, most of what we are invested in are private companies. So if you can't put those in the foundation, how does the foundation get its share? That is causing us to do some other things. So every new investment we make, the kids will own it rather than us. Mm-hmm. So that'll be part of their inheritance. So it's complicated.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, ours is not a big estate. Other people, if it's complicated for us, then there's a lot of people out there that maybe should join the round table and come to some meetings about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, everybody's got the tax advisors and accountants who will be happy to tell them how to do it.
Right.
But, yeah.
Do you have any other thoughts on philanthropy before we close off on this podcast? Any wise words?
I don't have wisdom on it, but I, you know, somebody said it's better to give than to receive, and it is. I mean, it is so wonderful when you see a need to actually be able to do something about it. I mean, you think being a politician is another way to do it, because then you can, you know, you've got some clout and you can phone the civil service and say, we need to do something here. But having money is not only a great gift, but it allows you to change things. So I took Jennifer with me a year ago to Ethiopia in Zambia, and took her to the Children of Prisoners program that was being run in Zambia. And we went to see the three or four families.
Mm.
And we came in, and Jennifer, she loved it. She just loved it. And she's bilingual, so she could speak to them and all the rest of it. But she came out of this one, and really they're shanties, you know. And she came out, and she just looked at me and she said, Dad, we can change the world. Because for their world, it doesn't take a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And you can change, you know, one world at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And that led us to do Rwanda, the project we're doing in Rwanda, and we're going to do the same thing in Zambia if we can raise the money. So that's all I'd say. If you've got money and you've got a heart to give, man, you're blessed.
Thank you, Jack, for your patient commitment to those who are often forgotten and invisible in our world today, prisoners. We often want to lock them up and throw away the key, but the call of Christ compels us to discover the humanity of each prisoner and to offer care despite the crime. Jack and Prison Fellowship International's leadership on this file is exceptional. More information is found in the link in the show notes. Also in the show notes is a link to Greg Penoyer, founder of The Roundtable, the philanthropy community mentioned by Jack in his talk today. You can email Greg if you'd like more information on joining. Those of you who listened to the previous podcast know that I am currently walking the Camino de Santiago in Spain during the month of August. I'd ask for your prayers during this time. Those who want to see photos of the walk can log into my Instagram account at LoveGivingWell for a taste of this arduous pilgrimage. Pilgrimage is becoming a key theme of mine. I'm happy to announce that I have a book coming out at the end of the year, published by Whipfin Stock, called LoveGivingWell: Philanthropy as Pilgrimage. In it, I draw on the metaphor of pilgrimage walking across Spain and compare it to the journey of philanthropy I've been on for the past 16 years. The book will introduce structure, strategy, and attitudes which are beneficial to anyone in the work of philanthropy. Subscribe to our e-newsletter to stay in touch with news about the launch of this book. That concludes today's podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our website at strongerphilanthropy.ca. Or you can find us on iTunes or your Android podcatcher apps. If you want to reach out, email me at strongerphilanthropy@gmail.com. Message me on Twitter at LoveGivingWell or Facebook at Stronger Philanthropy. Buen Camino.